Thank you, Oscar, for inviting me. Thank you all for being here this morning and for this opportunity to reflect back on 30 years in the field of journalism, both as a journalism professional and then as a journalism studies scholar. Now, this is a new kind of talk to me. I have never done this before. I very often just focus on the professional being and don't talk about my personal background or history here. But working with colleagues at UBC, working with others, makes you realize that actually we all come from somewhere. We all have a position from where we depart when we start on our research journey, when we start on our professional journey. And so what I hope to do here is to sort of take you through my journey, looking at, in some ways, how, as both a professional, as a scholar, as an individual, was navigating issues of institutional power, institutional authority, and identity, who you are in different contexts and how you represent yourself. This is new to me. I don't normally talk about this stuff, so you're my guinea pigs to try out this journey. So I hope you'll give me a little bit of latitude as we start on this. And for me, it starts off when I first started getting interested in journalism. I had to learn to type on a typewriter. It's like, you know, writing an assignment on a typewriter is a really bad idea because it's a lot of words. Fortunately, that didn't last very long and we moved on to word processors. But, you know, this is just a sort of sense of how things have moved along in terms of what we use and the tools we use and how these devices help us think in different ways. Because somehow when I was first learned to type on a typewriter, it becomes the nature of the medium imposes a very linear form of thinking because you can't go back. You can't sort of go back and say, oh, I'll write the middle bit first and then I'll go back to the introduction or I'll change this. You start at the beginning, you go to the middle, you go to the end. And I sort of started in that context. But of course, this is not just a journey of technology. This is a journey of societal, cultural, political transformation. And within that, how journalism and the field of journalism studies, as Mario pointed out this morning, has changed and developed. And yet, one thing that's always struck me, both as a journalist and as a scholar, is how resilient journalism as an institution, with these very strongly entrenched set of values, set of ways of working, has, you know, weathered this changes. I've always been struck how the strength of the institution. And what I've realized is that comes partly from my positionality and where I look that, and not in a sense being part of that institution, but feeling on the outside of it. Of course, you know, we can see these changes, just I'll use a little example. When I started at the BBC, going out to do a TV story meant this. There was a camera person, usually a cameraman, because they tended to be men. I usually had a sound man, again, men, because they tended to be men. And we would go and do something, and I'd be there as a reporter doing this journey. You know, and this is not actually that long ago. It is in the last century, but I'm not that old. So this is remarkable change that we've seen here from the way news gathering used to be to the tools that now everybody has to be their own journalist. Now, I'm presenting this as sort of binary and linear journey, but of course, it's not quite that clear. These forces intersect with each other. And I think the interest lies then in how the old and the new, the established and the novel, the traditional and the innovative exist side by side, how they negotiate power with each other, how they support or negate each other in this journey. So I want to take you back and think about the history of media. And I'm very influenced here by one of my UBC colleagues, Heidi Turek, who's written a book called News from Germany that looks how Germany sought to essentially control world communications in the 1930s through technology. And it resonates with a lot of what's happening now when we see powers like Russia seeking to control forms of communication through hacking, through shadow activities. So I highly recommend her book, Heidi Turek, News from Germany. So This book by Carolyn Marvin was written in 1988, and it's written around electricity. What electricity meant to communication. You know, we already know electricity changed a lot of things in our lives, so we could stay up late at night because we had light. But thinking about what it changed in terms of once you apply electricity to communication, things like the telegraph, the telephone, the phonograph, electric light, wireless, cinema, these things wouldn't exist in the form they existed without electricity. And not only do you have these sort of more forms of mass entertainment, you then also have the idea of the mass audience, that we all go and see this blockbuster film and millions of people see the same thing on a television show, on a movie screen. And, you know, sort of audiences then get organized around these mediums that formed. And I want to highlight this quote where she talks around that it's not about the technology. This is not a story of technology, but rather how existing groups then negotiate with each other in this space. And in many ways, we can see this with digital technologies and digitalization, that we have existing groups and other groups that perhaps existed but were not as visible or not as heard because they were being silenced by institutions of power, how they are negotiating issues of power, authority, representation, and knowledge, seeking to wrestle control from institutional elites or other power brokers through the means of these tools that are enabled through digital technologies. And what I find remarkable here is that it's you know, this is a perpetual struggle over emerging and contested practices of communication. And what this, in this process of negotiation, there's a sort of trying to find the social equilibrium to where things sort of are back to an understanding that everybody in their group shares. And this quote really struck me looking back at some of the research I've done, where it's like these new practices don't flow from the technologies, but they're basically improvised as we go along. And looking back at my professional career, at the time I didn't realize, but I was sort of improvising as I went along because old ways of doing it didn't work so well, so I sort of adapted and thought, okay, how do I, if this doesn't work anymore, what does work? Oh, I'll do it this way. That works. Okay, we'll carry on doing it that way. So this process of both negotiating power, authority, ways of knowing who creates that knowledge, and then the mix of old practices that may not fit very well in line and how new practices that emerge. But we always draw from a history. We always draw from what we know, who we are, and the environment around us. And these themes really resonate with me when I look back on some of the research I've done since joining the Academy in 2006. Now, I was a BBC journalist from 1990 to 2006, and then joined UBC in 2006, and I'm there till now. And I've been sort of attracted to these issues of participatory journalism, social media, and now on journalism innovation. And when Oscar asked me to think about what I wanted to talk about, what I wanted to share with you, it really was an opportunity to take a step back and think about how I've always, as an individual, been attracted to the novel, the new, the, ooh, how can I do this differently? I don't like the way they do it. I want to do it differently. I want to do something that challenges authority, that challenges institutions. And in some ways, that's kind of how my research has evolved. Almost, at the time, I didn't know that. But reflecting back on it, I see that I'm attracted to say, well, how does the ability of audiences to be more involved in the news process shape what journalism is, what it does, and its role in society? Social media, similar kind of issues in terms of how are groups that are being marginalized or misrepresented in the media seeking to correct historical flaws in reporting on these communities through means of themselves, and how is that then power negotiated with institutions, not just in journalism, but in politics and in other societal and cultural forces. So we see that, and then journalism innovation again, well, hey, that old way of doing stuff that you used to do, that doesn't work anymore. Let's try something new and different. So my approach and my personality has been geared to these things of saying, these old ways don't work, let's try something new. In some ways, biased very much towards the novel. But rooted in it is the story behind this, is trying to examine this struggle for power, for representation, and for knowledge. Who gets heard? Who is represented? What knowledge is being created? And how does that alter and affect power dynamics in society? And then, putting this together, I was realizing that, where does this come from? Where does this idea of seeking to challenge authority, seeking to think in terms of how can we improve representation? How can we improve issues of who gets heard, who's not heard? Some of that didn't come just from my professional formation and scholarly formation, but really I can trace it back to where I was born and where I'm from. So often people ask me, you know, where are you from? And usually I say London, because it's like easy. And I lived 20 years in London. So, you know, I always consider like London as part of my home, but London is not where I was formed. London is where I lived. Where I was formed is Gibraltar. Has anybody here been to Gibraltar? Excellent, perfect. So it's very strange. It's this tiny British pocket called a British Dependent Territory, British Dependent Overseas Territory, which is a posh way of saying colony, because we don't like saying colony. Though when I was born there and grew up there, it was still a colony, and then they changed in the 1980s, because you don't like talking about colonies anymore. It's a bad, bad word. But so I come from this place as essentially a British colony, where I look at my family as being there for generations over generations. I can trace one side of it back to the Crimean War, because I have these very cool wars from the Crimean medals from one of my ancestors like 160 years ago. But largely my background is Mediterranean, Spanish, Italian, a little bit of English there, Scottish rather than English, but sort of essentially Mediterranean. And living in a place like this, I was born there and I spent the first 19 years of my life before going to university. You know, this is a place with 32,000 people. It's 6.7 square kilometers, so it's kind of small. And it's been British since 1713. And largely its value at the time was as a military base, because it's at the Straits of Gibraltar, the entrance to the Mediterranean. So while I was growing up there, this was a very strong military presence, a very strong naval base. One of my first jobs when I took a gap year was working for the Ministry of Defense, which is kind of funny because I just took it because it was a job, not because of any interest in anything military, but it was a job, so let's do that. When I was growing up, very much in the shadow of Englishness, in a place that is very mixed culturally. So, look, here comes the cute family pictures. So, you know, I'm growing up here. This is my mum. I have two younger sisters. I'm the oldest, and I'm the boy. So I'm growing up at a time when Gibraltar is still considered a colony, still largely a large military presence and considered military significant. But in a situation where the systems are all as in the UK, so English is the official language, education is all the English system, O levels, A levels, etc. But in informal circles, you talk Spanish. And the place itself is a mix of bobbies on the beat, the red telephone boxes, and Spanish culture. And I don't have a Gibraltarian accent, because what I realized is I actually assimilated the accent of my English friends at school. I didn't plan to, but I did. So when I went to university, people would say, oh, you're from the south of England. I'm like, no. But I assimilated their accent because my friends were English and they were from the south of England. So I grew up in a framework of, in a sense, you're never English enough because you're not English. you're British, but not really British, you're Gibraltarian. You're Mediterranean. And normally, if you speak to a Gibraltarian, they will normally talk to each other in a mix of English and Spanish, switching from one language mid-sentence. And you get a very strange thing where more formal terms tend to be in English, because the education system, the institutions are all in English, but the informal terms, the casual language, is in Spanish, because that's sort of the cultural family background. So you have this real intersection of a colonial mindset and a grassroots family experience, and the negotiating power at the same time. And Gibraltar was a sort of weird place growing up in many ways. It was wonderful because the weather's great most of the time. You can go to the beach. You know, I spent 3 months essentially living on the beach. One time when I was about 13, I came back to school and my hair had gone blonde, like a dirty blonde, because I was going through puberty. And between puberty and spending 3 months on the beach and the sun and the salt, my hair had gone blonde. My hair does not look blonde and doesn't naturally go blonde. And so, of course, all my school friends were teasing me, saying, oh, you've dyed your hair. And I'm like, no, it's like just other stuff. But this is the environment. Growing up, it's a great environment. Small, protected, extended family, nice weather, but one that is a very bifurcated society. One where you have very much all the local population really in high-density environments. So you see some of the estates near the top of the picture. My sister lives there, my other sister lives there, my cousins lived there, we lived more in town, then my family moved there as well. But what you had in Gibraltar was a system where the best land was assigned to the military forces, to the Brits. And it was funny growing up because there were places that I, as a Gibraltarian, couldn't go because it's a military base, or not a military base in the sense of where the military families were being housed, and we weren't allowed to go there. I used to occasionally cheat by taking a shortcut through it and try to cycle as fast as possible and not get caught, because then they would turn you back. But I'm like, this is my land, this is my homeland, and you're telling me I don't have the right to go through your lovely estate that's by the water because I'm not English enough. So it's a very weird environment, thinking back on it. But I think that's sort of shaped me in terms of resisting power, but also not feeling part of the system, because I was never quite English enough. And the fact that I kind of assimilated an English accent is part of that sort of subconscious effort to be accepted as English, as British. So I sound like I'm English, I don't sound like I'm Spanish. Si hablo en español, es muy diferente. Soy una persona completamente diferente. Tengo un acento diferente. La manera de hablar es completamente diferente. Es una persona diferente. So when I talk to people in Spanish and they know me from English, they go like, hey, what happened? Like, this is a different person. Because there's a different cultural identity that gets associated with language. My wife is English. And when I do this, she's like, what happened to you? You became a different person. Because somehow you have a different cultural context there. But what struck me here is, in doing some of the research then in journalism, is in some ways I see myself as a peripheral actor in journalism. I was never at the core. I came up through an institutional system that was exported from the UK to this tiny bit of Britain in the Mediterranean. But at the periphery and not at the core. And looking back at some of my professional trajectory, you can see both an attempt to become part of that core, to become accepted, but at the same time challenging and not wanting to be at the core. A dichotomy there that plays out in both professional life and scholarly life. And I think this is some of the tensions we see then with digitalization happening in newsrooms, where, you know, established ways of doing may not work so well. You're coming up against novel actors, challenges to ways of doing, and you're negotiating this power, this transition. Peripheral actors who maybe are now not quite as peripheral as they used to be because of technologies, cultural changes, societal changes that allow them to take a more central role in journalism. And there's that negotiation of power and authority. You know, Perhaps, you know, ironically, and this is reflecting back as I was preparing this, is my professional life essentially was shaped by the BBC. I joined the institution that was the epitome of Britishness, of the British Empire, the BBC. I spent pretty much all my professional career at the BBC, starting off as a BBC News trainee, which is this prestigious scheme. Thousands of people apply for it. You get a first interview, you do a test, then you do a second interview, then you do another test, and eventually you get through, and eight people make it through. So for me, part of getting into the BBC News trainee scheme against this competition was to prove that I was worth it, that I, as a boy from Gibraltar, could beat the best of the English at their own game, which is a weird kind of thing, because at the time I didn't think of it like that. I just thought, like, this is what I want to do. But driving us, there's always a positionality. We always come from somewhere. And so it's reflecting back as how does the place we come from, the view we have from somewhere, then shape our actions and decisions. Of course, I joined the BBC, which is all about the view from nowhere. Impartiality, we don't have opinions. And I essentially assimilated all the BBC values. At the time when I joined the BBC, one of the things they do is, I don't think they do it anymore, but this is back in the 90s, they would send you for voice training. And my trainer was a white English guy, older white English guy, with like the plummiest Queen's English accent. Hello, this is the BBC, like this. And I'm like, and essentially you've got a voice training, so they're trying to teach you to speak like that. And I'm like, and I tried really hard to speak like that, except I do not speak like the BBC in the voice of authority. But that was part of the sort of socialization of new people to get them to sound like essentially this white male voice of empire. Fortunately, that has changed. But what I didn't realize, of course, is as I sort of spent my time at the BBC, and I spent 4 years in the Middle East as a correspondent, that you actually become BBC-eyed. You become part of the establishment. One time, as in Cairo, and a friend of mine said to me, how come you all sound the same? And I'm like, what do you mean? Well, when I hear you on the radio and I hear somebody else, all BBC correspondents sound the same. You all sound like BBC correspondents. Do they train you like that? And it gave me pause to think, because I thought, well, no. So how did I learn to sound like a BBC correspondent? Well, I listened to other BBC correspondents and then subconsciously emulated them, because you want to be accepted as a BBC correspondent. And again, a very subconscious thing. I wasn't deliberately saying I have to sound like this, but I have to have the BBC voice of authority, which sometimes comes out when I'm giving lectures. I switch from Alf chatting to Alf, voice of authority, listen to me, learn this stuff, it'll be important to you. So again, there's processes here that happen without us almost realizing, as in terms of not socialization, just in terms of practices, but also socialization in how we conceive of roles, how we conceive of our place in these institutions. And in this sense, not challenging that, but wanting to be accepted by assimilating it. At the same time, when I was looking back at this, I sort of realized that I was always attracted to places within the BBC that were more at the periphery of what the BBC did. So I did a stint in TV news, which is supposedly like the apex of the pyramid in BBC news, working for domestic television news for the national news broadcast, the apex. Hated every minute of it, because it was very hierarchical, very command and control, very much like you've got to eat dirt for 2 years before you're allowed to do anything. And I'm like, no. And I actually had a falling out with one of the editors, because I would have to do a 10-hour shift and they'd give me work that I could do in 2 minutes. And I complained. And the editor was, you're like the news trainee. That's what you get. The rest of the time you can watch. And I'm like, this is a complete waste of time. And actually, we agreed to move me to a different program, because me and this editor did not get on, because I was resistant. I was saying, no, you cannot treat me like dirt. Just because you don't like trainees, you can't do that. And I resisted that. But what I found is I actually found my home in places that were more at the periphery, not at this apex of, quotes, BBC journalism, but at places like BBC World Service, the Latin American service, because, of course, I speak Spanish. At places like being a foreign correspondent, but based in Tunisia, and then after I got expelled from Tunisia, in Egypt. And I got expelled in Tunisia because I take no shit from governments. Or rather, I do the thing of, well, if you're going to commit human rights abuses, I will report on them. It's kind of my job. And I can tell you more about that if you like later. But then places like World Television, which again wasn't part of the mainstream, but it was one place where there was people trying to do stuff that, okay, we didn't think of ourselves as we're not the apex of BBC News, but there's possibility to do stuff. And also spaces where I found individually more capacity to make a contribution. And then finally joining BBC News Online. So now this might look like this is this very well-planned trajectory, but for those of you wishing to pursue a career in journalism, A, it's hard to plan a trajectory, but this does not happen by luck or by chance. You create these opportunities by, in some ways, being in the right place at the right time, but having people aware of what you can offer at that time. And News Online was that. I was working World TV. My editor comes along one day and says, Alf, they're going to launch this website for the elections in 1997. They're looking for some people to go over for a few months to help with it and do it. Like, you've been online. And I'm like, yeah, I've been online for a couple of years. I went online in 1994 when I was in Egypt. So I'm like, you've been online. Oh, you know the internet. Good, great. Then and you have an email address. Like, yeah, I have two. It's like, whoa, you've been online and you have two email addresses. You must be an expert on the internet. So therefore, I said, okay, do you want to go and do this thing? I'm like, sure, let's go and try this thing. And election, and so that's where it kind of started. And election 97, which then became politics 97, was really interesting in terms of not just what we were doing, but the people who were there. Essentially, it was basically composed of BBC News refugees, people who didn't really fit in other places and wanted to try something new. We loved animated GIFs at the time because it was like, oh, look, we can animate stuff. Whoa, this is awesome. This is for the budget, which was from the first Labour government in 1997. So we ripped off Reservoir Dogs and did Mr. Brown, because it was Gordon Brown, was the finance minister at the time. The BBC would never allow this. But because we were this group of BBC News refugees doing this online stuff that nobody really knew about, we weren't in the main news building. We were over in the administrative building. We were crammed into a little room. And my managing editor would call me once a day and say, hey, Alf, how are things going? Yep, things are going fine. We're doing this, we're doing that. So great, okay, I'll call you later. And that was it. I look back and I go like, wow, this is remarkable. We had so little oversight and so much freedom. But part of the attraction was that in a sense, there was no template for this. There was no way of doing things. And part of this came out of Tony Hall, who was the director of news at the time, and now the director general, where essentially, and John Burt, who was the director general at the time, who essentially saw the internet, it's happening, BBC News needs to be there, okay, you sort it out. And kind of that's sort of what happened here. What was interesting at the time, the BBC were talking about things like, you will get the news you want and the news you want 24 hours a day. This is like novel that actually this was a website that's being updated all the time. We sort of explored ways of animated GIFs and other stuff. But we also did participatory journalism, though at the time we didn't call it that, and it wasn't like we sat around and thought, how can we get the audience engaged? We should do participatory journalism. It was more, ooh, we could ask people to email us their questions. Ooh, let's do that. We could do a quiz. Let's do that. oh, we could do a forum with experts and people could ask their questions. Let's do that. In some ways, it was not a strategic move, but rather these BBC News refugees thinking, well, we don't really like the way TV news works with sort of radio news. We want to do something else. And really coming quite organically. There was no plan here, and very much a group thing. Like, you know, this is, you know, animated GIFs were not my idea. This is a designer who thought, oh, this would be cool. And we were like, cool. We can get things to move. This is awesome. Again, we weren't thinking, what's the editorial value? We were just, we can do this, let's do this, with minimum supervision. And when then the BBC then launched sort of BBC News formally 6 months later, again, very much that was structured not outside of the main operation. It was very much like a semi-autonomous republic within the BBC. We were on the seventh floor on a wing of the main building. The main news was on the fourth, sort of first, second, third, fourth floor. We were seventh floor, but on a wing, so well away from anywhere else. And our boss, Bob Eggington, he saw his role as telling the best rest of the BBC to F off. Like, go away, we're doing this online thing, leave us alone. It was very interesting in terms of we were physically on the periphery of news, and we had a boss whose job, he saw his job as stopping the core from interfering in the periphery. It was fascinating reflecting back on it and on that philosophy. And part of that was to say, well, if you're trying out something new, you need to give it room to try something new. And very much trying to resist the old practices from television and radio coming in and telling us what to do. Of course, the newsroom is composed of some people from outside the BBC and journalists from within the BBC. So you have BBC journalists, so you have the BBC mindset. We've all been assimilated into the BBC values. But you have a group of people who are thinking, well, I don't really like these old practices. What else can I do here? And really drawn by the novelty of this space. And then a boss who essentially says, I will give you the space to try things out. And I look back on it and I go, wow, I had so much autonomy as an editor. Because a journalist, one of the team, could come along and suggest an idea, and we'd discuss it, and then we'd go, hey, let's just try it. And then we'd realize that was not a good idea, so we didn't do it anymore. But the BBC is an incredibly bureaucratic place where everything needs to get multiple approvals, but this was set up at the periphery in a way that allowed the freedom to try things out and explore what this space of online journalism was about. And, you know, I really enjoyed my time there. It was a tremendous experience to be involved in that. Though at the time, I'm not thinking of, oh, we're doing this new thing, we're exploring these frontiers of journalism. It was more like, hey, what can we do here? What works, what doesn't work? And really very responsive to the audience because we had metrics. And again, not, you know, there's work being done now and have news response to web analytics. It wasn't so much that we were looking at them and saying, how do we act? But it was another signal to say, is this something that's resonating with audiences? But again, there wasn't sort of a strategic plan for us as journalists saying, this is the direction we want to see. But for me, when I look back on this, what's remarkable is how the team there were doing ways of involving audiences before this thing was called participatory journalism. And before we had some of the more utopian rhetoric in the early 2000s around this possibility of user-generated content, citizen journalism, which is a term I detest, but this idea that somehow the audience has the tools to challenge journalism. And, of course, at the time, a significant degree of hyperbole around this. For those of you familiar, this was like a seminal report at the time by Willis and Bowman, talking around, you know, hey, this is amazing, the audience has the power to do this, that suddenly we're being threatened and these new technologies, these new practices are allowing audiences to take on some of the roles of journalism. And so part of this prompted a whole series of research into this, I was involved with some of this with my colleague Neil Thurman, with others, Debbie Domingo, Jane Singer, Thorsten Quant, a whole bunch of people, looking in terms of saying, well, there's these claims being made. What is actually happening? How is the institution of journalism responding to what could be seen as a challenge to its authority, to its claim to represent society, its claim to create knowledge in this space? And we wrote a whole book about it in 2011 called Participatory Journalism, looking at newspapers across the world and how online they were incorporating or not citizen participation. Of course, what the body of work here found that really, you know, in some ways, there's not that, you know, journalists weren't exactly embracing the audience. What we found across ourselves and a whole other bunch of researchers is, yeah, we're not really sharing the road. It's a bit like when you have cars and cyclists, and suddenly they create bike lanes, but they're not really delineated, and cars don't respect them. It's almost that analogy with participatory journalism, where, yes, we'll set up the bike lanes, but we won't really respect them, and we won't pay my attention, and we'll still privilege cars, because actually cars are what matters. Cars are the important aspect here. So, again, as a research topic attracted to something saying, how could these peripheral actors, who now have a capacity to take on a more central role, how is the core, how is the center reacting to them? And this is where these professional notions of journalism come in. The idea that, you know, notions of journalism are rather, they're not inclusive and aimed at facilitating audience participation, but rather at excluding, at creating a body of knowledge, an institution that says, we are the people that know how to do this. We have a claim to knowledge in the means of producing public knowledge. We may not be experts in the topic, but we're the experts in how to produce that knowledge for consumption by the public. And we don't really want to share with that. So yes, please send us your pictures of breaking news, or send us your pictures of sunsets, and we'll feature them on the news. I'm sure you've seen this. It's amazing. I saw this the other day in one of the news bulletins, and I'm like, really? 2019, we're still doing, here's a sunset picture from the audience? I just despair. Because I'm sort of like, well, there's so much more you could do, and this is what you're still doing. But I think this is where we come to these themes in terms of, you know, how power and identity and authority is negotiated. And when you have old practices coming about new practices, and this negotiation, and either acceptance, adaptation, or attempts to negate or marginalized. And certainly with a lot of participatory journalism, that's what was happening. It wasn't happening everywhere, but even at the BBC, the BBC had a sort of user-generated content unit very early on, around 2001. And there was a seminal change when the London bombings of 2005 came along. Because suddenly, the video of people coming out of the tube stations and in the tubes came from citizens, you know, mobile shaky video. And that was the first time that evening on the TV news bulletin, the apex of the news establishment, they used mobile video from a citizen. Badly shot, shaky, grainy, but it had a sense of immediacy. And it was a shift in the BBC at that point where they suddenly realized, whoa, we don't have a reporter there, but we can use this material so they can become part of our news gathering arm. And the shift then became that the sort of user-generated content at the online site was suddenly taken seriously by radio and TV. But what happened is essentially they were assimilated to become part of news gathering. So it was less of, hey, tell us what we should be covering. Tell us what do you think we should do. What should we put on the news? In 2001, they did try one experiment with a news bulletin to say, tell us what should be on the running order. What should we cover today? And let the audience run the show. Happened once and never again. But in 2000, so that is participation. But in 2005, suddenly, so TV, particularly TV, woke up to the fact, oh, you can become part of our news gathering operations. And so the shift, A, there was more resources towards user-generated content, but very much in a news gathering phase, rather than the, hey, tell us what we should put in our news bulletin. What should we report? Yeah, that was an experiment in 2001. It happened once and then never again. And I don't really know why, but I suspect it's because telling the audience, you know, asking the audience what should we report is like, no, we're the journalists, we're the editors, we know what you want, so let us tell you. So I'm going to play you a clip which I think really sums up this shift in how participatory journalism was being watched. There's another part of this clip that I'm not going to play, but it's on YouTube. If you search for that Mitchell of Webb look, it's What Do You Reckon? And the second part is just as funny as this one.
...catastrophe of vast proportions. We asked the Minister for Shipping to comment on that story, but she just yawned.
But who needs her when we've got you? What do you think about this issue? Do you have any thoughts? What are those thoughts? Will you tell us them? Any thoughts at all will do. If you have them, we want to hear them.
Are you personally affected by this issue? Then email us. Or if you're not affected by this issue, can you imagine what it would be like if you were? Or if you already are affected by it but don't want to talk about it, can you imagine what it would be like not to be affected by it? Why not email and tell us?
Yes, why not? What possible reason could there be for you not to email us? Certainly ignorance shouldn't be a bar. You may not know anything about the issue, but I bet you reckon something. So why not tell us what you reckon? Let us enjoy the full majesty of your uninformed ad hoc reckon by going to bbc.co.uk/meandmyimportantthoughts, all one word, clicking on What I Reckon, and then simply beating on the keyboard with your fists or head.
Here's some of the feedback we've had so far. Andrew from Eastbourne reckons it's a sad indictment of the way we live. Matthew from Ilkley reckons it isn't. Patricia from Southampton wonders what Wordsworth would say and thinks she knows. And James from Amersham would like the fire brigade quickly, for God's sake, he's trapped.
Thanks for those, and keep those emails coming. It is, for some reason, apparently vital that you do.
Yeah, so please email, you know, me and my big thoughts at nobodycares.com. So for me, this really, and this is more than 10 years old, but it's startling that, I don't know how much you still come across this in the media. Like, tell us what you reckon. Not what do you know, what's your experience. What do you reckon? Do you have a thought about this? Like, you know, for me, it's like, well, yes, you've always had this asking people to tell us what you think. But this is not really involving them in the process of how that knowledge is being created or who's been represented. There's another half of this clip. It's alien invasion. It's very cool. So that Mitchell and Webb look, Alien Invasion, it's on YouTube. You can look it through the break. But essentially what we see here are these questions of authority, autonomy, and ability. That we're saying, who has the authority to do journalism? Journalists do. Well, if there's others wanting to do this, how much do we open up to them? Not very much. We are autonomous. We are the ones that get to decide the running order. We are the people who decide this is what the news is. And we are the ones with the special skills, the abilities to do this. And of course, this is because journalists see themselves as, you know, essential in civic democracies. And they fall back on these ideas. And, you know, the audience are these stormtroopers who are suddenly challenging them. And we don't like this. We need to build up more defenses and keep them out. Or find ways of involving them which pays nominal service, nominal lip service to the idea of a more open and journalism. And I was looking back on, you know, how was I involved in this? And I was pretty much just as guilty of doing this as everybody else. So one of the things I did when I was at the BBC is I set up a technology vertical because I identified a deficit in coverage of technology. It was all done from a business side or a gadget side, rather than a societal cultural side. So I persuaded the bosses that we should have a separate vertical on this. And every year I'd go to E3, which is essentially like covering a giant video arcade, living in a video arcade for 3 days. But at the time, even then, we were still experimenting with some of this, but still very much with keeping that position of autonomy. My team and I at technology, where we tried this experiment where the editor-in-chief said, We're going to experiment with putting reporters' emails at the bottom of stories. Alf, you and your team are open to new ideas. Why don't we try it with your team? I'm like, what, you want the great unwashed to have my email address? To be able to email me and tell them what they reckon? Okay, let's do this. And we tried it, and I got some abuse, and I got some valuable comments. But my very personal recollection from there is one time where I had an email of somebody who's like, BBC, you do this, you're bad, you blah, 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 BBC's terrible. And I replied and said, thank you for your email, blah, blah, it's an engineer point of view, you know, we try to do X, Y, and Z. Person replies back and goes, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I was so rude, I didn't realize somebody would read this. Because, of course, to the public, the BBC is this monolith, is this unresponsive monolith that never listens. So it was a fascinating personal interaction where here's a personal email address and that person is still expecting it to go into the bottomless pit of BBC emails that nobody ever looks at. And of course, their email was, sorry, didn't realize somebody was going to read this. I love the BBC, you do great work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, oh, okay, you don't hate us after all. But what I personally learned there is the power of listening. That it's not just about, say, tell us what you think, but actually acknowledging that you are listening to what other people are telling you. And that listening and acknowledgement is incredibly powerful. That experiment with email addresses didn't last very long. There was sort of institutional resistance from journalists saying, well, this will add to our burden of work, and our job is not to reply to emails from the public. Again, they're sort of, you know, old practices, new practices coming together and one negating the other. But even still, at the time, you know, some of the stuff we were doing, like this Q&A, was still placing somebody like myself as the expert. I'm the one with the authority and the ability to answer your comments. So yes, I'm more open because you can ask me questions, but I am still placing myself as the journalist, as the authoritative figure in this exchange. I am still the one with the power. And then the photo on your right is from the We Media conference that the BBC hosted in 2006. The BBC hosted a conference where they were trying to sort of bring old media, legacy media, with new media and bloggers and participatory practices and bring them all together. And I my boss asked me, you know, we want to like have live coverage from it. Do you want to live blog it? And I'm like, sure, I'll give it a try because, as you know, I like trying novel stuff. So because I was the BBC blogger, I was sitting on the blogger's desk because at this conference they had a desk of bloggers because the BBC had invited in bloggers. And the other bloggers on this desk really resented me because what they saw in me was not a fellow blogger. They saw a BBC intruder, somebody coming in and challenging their authority, their autonomy, their ability. It's like I was camping on their lawn. And there was a fascinating personal thing, because it wasn't personal. It was more that I was embodied this monolith of the BBC who had suddenly, in 2006, discovered blogging and just decided, hey, we should be there. Let me camp on your lawn. And they resisted it. And it was a fascinating personal experience in terms of when you enter somebody's space to acknowledge that they are the authority in that space. They're the ones with the autonomy, and you're negotiating with them rather than imposing who you are there. This led me to my journey through social media, and partly it was, again, thinking about what are these spaces outside of institutional journalism, and how do they enable audiences to both find the news, decide what's important, coordinate, activate. And really thinking as social media as the audience deciding all the news that's fit to share. So they're making editorial decisions on what gets assigned attention. And for me, social media had a sort of an immediate appeal because it challenged institutional authority. It challenged this thing of we're the journalists, we should tell you what to do. And instead, I looked at it in terms of, oh, this is fascinating, this is really interesting. Again, I think largely drawn from my positionality as somebody growing up in a colonial setup, wanting to be part of the system, but at the same time being resistant to the system. And seeing social media as this sort of space of paradoxes, because news is everywhere on social media, but at the same time it's nowhere, it's no particular place, which goes back to some of the methods questions that Mario asked this morning. How do we study news when we can't agree on what news is or where it is or how it exists in those spaces? These are spaces where people don't necessarily go for news, but they're about social interactions. And yet news is part of that. And news has always been part of social interactions. So it's not news-seeking behavior, it's social patterns of exchange and communication where news plays part of that. When audiences are playing a role in deciding how to assess information, how to integrate it into their way of knowing, into existing memories, and how to re-articulate it. One of the studies I did with my colleague Candice Collison was looking at one of these movements, Idle No More, which was an indigenous-led movement in Canada in 2010-2011, largely in reaction to Conservative Party environmental legislation that essentially would wipe out indigenous rights in favor of the resource industry. And what was fascinating there was looking at the discourse happening on social media around the Idle No More hashtag that was largely indigenous-led, and yet the discourse in mainstream media, legacy media, that can, A, marginalize the movement, talk to them about, oh, the natives are making noises with their drums again, which, seriously, one newspaper columnist did say that basically the natives are drumming, are making a noise with their drums again. What the hell is going on? They should be quiet, know their place. Seriously, that was published in a mainstream, large circulation daily in Canada. But on social media, there was a completely different articulation of the ideas of the movement, what they were reading, who was being heard, different voices rising to the fore that were being represented in the media itself. So suddenly there's these two parallel universes with engaged individuals on social media around this, creating their own media and their own media sources and listening to people, influencers, who were influential at time and place of that movement, and yet journalists reporting on this in a sort of complete abstract without relating to what was going on there. So I really found that sort of this, how this power is shared and negotiated, fascinating. But one of the things that came out of this was my 2010 paper for Journalism Practice called Twittering the News, The Rise of Ambient Journalism, which is my most cited paper ever, and also the most cited paper in Journalism Practice, I'm very pleased to say. And again, this was not planned. This was thinking around, you know, social media, particularly Twitter, as this space where things pop up and grab your attention. So Twitter's always on, but you're not necessarily always on Twitter. And occasionally you dip into it, but sometimes certain things rise to the fore because enough people decide this is important. So this idea then of an environment where news is ambient, where the media becomes an awareness system, operating in the periphery, but occasionally certain things rise to prominence and attention. And so these are the things that then become the news. And other people then have worked on this in terms of thinking about it. But I want to share an anecdote of how this paper came about, because I basically have to credit Marilyn Young. So Marilyn and I, as my colleague at UBC, have done a lot of work with her and continue to work with her. We're walking down one of the shishi neighborhoods in Vancouver. It's coffee shops and yoga places. And I'm talking to her about, you know, social media being this awareness system and how stuff happens in the periphery and rises to prominence and all this kind of stuff. And she says, you should write a paper on that. And I'm like, really? It's like, yeah, you should write a paper on that. I'm like, okay, like, I'll do that. And then I went back and started doing some more of the lit review and looked at other systems. And awareness systems are very present in the literature on HCI and computer systems, not so much in comms and journalism studies. And one thing I learned there is the value of looking outside your field, where actually some of the, I think, more of the interesting research is done when we step outside of the comfort zone of journalism studies or communication studies and look at how does the field of computer science look at this topic and what do we learn from it. If we take a different lens And it sort of feeds back to this theme of stepping outside our institutional environment. We're an institutional environment of journalism studies, of communication studies. And yet, what I found, and both in my own research and in other people's research, sometimes the value comes from taking a step outside at the periphery and taking that lens and looking at what was happening here. And for this, was largely influenced by the literature in HCI, human-computer interaction, and computer systems, that was thinking about computer networks and computers as awareness systems of what was going on. And of course, others have then developed this, like Cesi Papachurisi, and talked about the idea of effective news in this environment. You know, how do we understand social media spaces as different to the institutional spaces of journalism, where there are a different set of values at play, instantaneity, effective values, emotion, subjective experience, all these things come together, and where questions of authority are fluid and negotiated and dynamic and change over time, which again goes back to one of the points Mario made this morning. How do we study something that is fluid, that is contextual, that is happening perhaps within a network, as Candice and I found when we looked at Idle No More? You know, looking at that data set, we could see how certain people rose as influencers at a certain point in time and were very influential for 2 months and then completely disappeared. So at that time, we found one of the most influential people during that time on the Idle No More network was a Native American from Dakota, who basically rose to prominence because she did an Idle No More she was in Egypt at the time and did an Idle No More protest outside the Canadian embassy with her and her friend. But other people in the network saw that, promoted it, and then she started getting more attention and she became a sort of very influential voice in this movement. So she had power assigned by the network, but only at that point in time for that topic, and then was no longer involved. So again, personally, I find these processes fascinating because it does speak to, again, the questions of authority and identity and power, and particularly on social media, how not only are they shared, but they're also fairly fluid. And it's not necessarily that somebody who's influential at a particular time in a particular context is going to be influential further in a different time and place and context, which does raise questions for us as researchers in terms of how do we understand how this knowledge is created, who's creating this knowledge, who are the influencers, for lack of a better word, who has authority to speak on these issues at this particular time. And of course, what we see on social media is that there are certain people who decide to speak about these issues. And what I find really interesting about social media is that yes, you have this kind of stuff, and journalists love Twitter, perhaps too much, and journalism studies researchers love Twitter, like myself, partly because it's like awesome, but also because you can get the data set, and journalists love it, and politicians love it, etc. But this is a space where you have that subjective experience, opinion, and emotion rubbing side by side. So the same time I saw this, I also saw this. Stephanie, one of our colleagues who was at the Volta conference, recently had her baby. And I asked her, can I share this with the group? She's like, sure, fine. So I did. Even though it was public, I thought, well, if I use it in this sense, it's public on Twitter, so it's public, but would she be fine with me using it in a public context here in a talk that has been videoed? So again, there's questions of publicness and what we mean by public or the public. But you have, you know, this is a sort of a strange space for journalists. Because at the same time as having news, you have news, but different types of news, but it's interest to a particular audience. And of course, one thing that we see with social media is that in some ways, much like with other researchers at the time, we sort of get blinded to certain things. We look at Twitter and we can get the data and journalists are on it and we think, wow, Twitter's amazing. We should study Twitter. And then of course, Twitter is like a very small subset and select group of individuals, and we have all the limitations around, well, this is studying this group in this context at this time, but actually it doesn't reflect the broader one. And, you know, Seth and Logan did a really great article thinking and say, what are some of the assumptions that have come into how we've looked at social media? In fact, one of my blind spots, and this is also working with Seth, was looking at people like Andy Carvin and how they're using social media and saying, wow, this is a really interesting way of a journalist working in a shared space and willing to share some of that autonomy and some of that authority and some of that ability with the network. This is amazing. And then, of course, who else has done that? One or two journalists? Now, at the time, I was looking and thinking, this is great. This is like a prototype journalist for social media, except it didn't catch on. Even though as much as I wish that I wish it had, and looking at it and thinking, this is amazing, this is great, this is a different way of thinking how the journalist operates in a network. So my blind spot there was assuming that everybody would see this is amazing and a better way of doing journalism. These new practices would be better than old practices, but we're still asking for people for their sunset pictures. So that's my own personal blind spot. And comes from, again, my positionality as somebody looking for, hey, this novel way is a better way of doing things. Why don't we do it this way? Which brings me round to the latest thing I'm working on, which is around the theme of journalism innovation. And in a sense, this has been a theme throughout work. And I would say innovation is not just a story about technology. It's also about cultural, societal, political, economic innovation, different ways of thinking. And this is a project that, again, I'm doing with Marilyn Young. And Candice is also involved, and a group of other researchers, both at UBC and other universities. And when we started working on this, again, you look back at your career, you look back at where you come from, and I started to see patterns. Why is it that I'm drawn to study this particular topic, to do things in this space? And then I look back at my professional career at the BBC and suddenly go, huh. I was what's called an institutional entrepreneur. So somebody working within an institution trying to do essentially new things within that institution. So BBC News Online, our BBC Election 97, Politics 97, using our GIFs. That is innovating within an institution. And looking back in my career, I suddenly realized that in some ways I always sought out opportunities that allow me to do this, even though at the time I didn't think of myself like that. So it's kind of, as I come to this part of my junction in my research career, I sort of look back and say, oh, there were these points where I did this. So one of the things in 2001, the World Service was launching one of its first podcasts. It was about technology, and they want to say, well, we should partner with the website. I'm like, yeah, let's do this, because I was running the technology side of the website. And we were doing this live webcast with images and pictures and podcasting it, and then it was being broadcast on the radio or a day later. So at the time, really quite novel because nobody else was doing this. And the whole idea of doing a live webcast to try to complement the sound with images was kind of like TV but in a different format. And again, I did that because we had a team of people saying we want to do this. Instead of just doing a radio show, can we do something that's more digital? And we did. Again, a bunch of people who thought of how can we take old practices and think about new practices and build on that. And in some ways, I see the sort of dotted line, even launching the technology vertical of the BBC was part of that, saying we're not talking about technology seriously enough. One thing that my team and I were really focused on is covering video games seriously, much like the media covers the media industry, the creative industries, the arts, and cinema. We wanted to cover video games seriously, to talk of them as a cultural force, societal, political force, not just as, hey, this new game and you can kill aliens, which is what was happening in the press. So Journalism Innovation, this is a project that we started in 2015, and we were looking at partly the Canadian media landscape, and thinking of the shifting climate in journalism. In Canada, much as in similar mature markets like that, there's been a sort of decline in the largely commercial media system. It's highly concentrated. You have a public service broadcaster that is not particularly well-funded comparatively to others. And thinking, what can we do in this space? And for some of this, we were inspired by The Conversation. The Conversation is a project that started in 2011 in Australia, then spread to the UK, US, now Canada, also in Indonesia, also in France, and also in Spain. And the conversation model is essentially that the academic is the journalist. So there is a team of journalists, the editorial team, but all the authors are academics. And the aim is to say, well, there's a great deal of expert analysis, commentary, explanation that can come of the academic sector. But the challenge is making it accessible to the public in a way that's accessible. What are journalists good at? What is the journalist ability? The way of knowing how to take knowledge and make it into forms that are accessible to the public. So the model here partners the academics as authors with the journalism team as editors to help the academics write in a more journalistic way, turning the journalists into academics. And for this, this project was interesting because we were both, Marilyn is also a former journalist, so we were both operating as journalists and as scholars, because our research aim here was to say, if we take this model of explanatory journalism, of expert-informed analysis and commentary to Canada, and study, does it work? Does it matter? Does it have a policy impact? Does it help civic discourse? We have to actually bring the conversation to Canada. So we got some research funding to basically do that. We said to the main funding research agency, we want to try this in Canada, but to do this, we actually need to create a digital startup called The Conversation Canada, and we need money to do that. We need to create the lab to study this. And so we got some federal funding. We got $250,000 of federal funding, and that helped us through with working through getting this going. And on this journey, what we both realized is journalism is by far the easiest part here. Doing the journalism is easy. It's everything else. It's having a 10-year financial plan for your business, which when somebody in the nonprofit sector asked us, what's your 10-year financial plan? We're like, what, 10 years? What? Like, oh my God, you mean, no, you need one, because that shows you know what you're talking about, that you're serious, you can project forward and have things that you can expect and how you're going to adapt. A business plan that is rigorous, navigating the legal network to set up a nonprofit, navigating HR, because you're going to hire journalists to work here. There's a whole set of supports beyond doing the journalism that actually don't exist to support journalism, digital-born news organizations, because these are abilities beyond what you normally learn in a journalism master's program. You're not taught to do a 10-year financial projection. We had a lot of help from the nonprofit sector and people who gave us their time to help us do this. And we had to do a lot of fundraising. Again, in journalism schools, you're not taught how to raise money. You're not taught how to close. How do you present a value proposition? How do you sell it? Because you can't say, you know, journalism is dying, we want to do good journalism. That's not a value proposition. So, and then going into meetings with, because the model is funded by universities, going to meetings with university presidents or VPs and saying, this is what we're doing, this is what the money we want from you, where do I send the invoice? Closing the deal. It's, you know, like, so ask your teachers, they need to teach you how to do a value proposition, how to do a financial plan, and how to close a deal, how to close. Fortunately, I'm fairly shameless, so I would just go, blah, 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 okay, we've been talking for half an hour, you seem keen, where do I send the invoice? Like, okay, like now I need you to commit, not just talk about this. We've had three meetings, I want your cash. In some ways, it's not that different from journalism, because you ask somebody, you talk to somebody, eventually say, yes, we're going to go on the record, except this is money, and somehow it feels dirty when you're a journalist. We raised $1.5 million to launch this thing, which is quite incredible, and it was a tremendous learning process. But again, for this was part of, again, if I locate this in my professional personal scholarly journey, it was part of saying, well, there's a problem with journalism. What can we do to address that? What can I do? What can we do in our privileged positions as tenured academics with access to research funding to do something about this? Because while we were doing this, of course, we still had our day jobs. We had our tenured jobs. We make no money from this. We've never made a cent from the conversation. We're doing it as scholars and as our research. But again, we're in a privileged position as tenured academics that we don't have to pay the bills while we try to fundraise to launch something like this. And then it feeds into the research agenda. And this, again, falls within that framework of saying, how is power and knowledge representation? How is this negotiated? We have a couple of research projects in papers on the go. Both of them are fairly nearly complete, fairly nearly done. I won't go into details, but again, what part of this was looking at, you know, particularly with the digital-born outlets in Canada, there's a narrative in the mainstream press and in sort of the mainstream that journalism is dying, there is no innovation, we'd better say local news is dying, we need to support legacy media. And Canada recently introduced a new media policy providing $600 million over 5 years to support the media. Except the way the media policy is structured, it's going to support legacy media. They're going to make between $6 and $10 million a year from this new policy. It's not really going to support this, because it was done in an absence of research about what is actually happening. Who are these digital-born startups? And again, we're attracted to that, and I'm attracted to that because I want to see what is happening outside of these legacy newsrooms. Who is trying to do something different? And so one of the things that we're also looking at is not just funding, but also who are the people setting this up? And a scholar whose name I can't remember has done some research in this area and found that often these new digital-born pure plays are essentially legacy journalist refugees. So they're legacy refugees who somehow feel that their home institution is not doing the job that journalism should be doing, and therefore they need to leave and repair journalism and return it to its civic duty. So we're going to do some more research on that. But again, attracted by, in some ways, these outsiders who decided that the inside doesn't work for them anymore, and they want to do something from the outside. Which sort of brings us back to where we started. Thinking around, you know, how these groups negotiate power. And this talk really gave me an opportunity to think through not just the research that's been undertaken, not just some of the big themes we've seen in journalism studies, but how you can locate them in your personal journey. How your formative years, how your socialized, your years of socialization within certain industries then shapes the questions you ask, the approaches you take, and essentially addressing some of the key tensions we see within journalism studies. You know, I think this is the key thing that we're all grappling with, and Mario's presentation pointed to this. You know, how do these groups negotiate power? How are they represented differently? What are the different forms? How do we study them? Where are they? Who are they? How do they form? Can we track them? Can we not? Do they exist in places we don't normally look at? Are they not the people we normally talk to? These are all questions that I think really come to the heart of journalism studies and a lot of questions around the journalism industry itself. And, you know, we all come from somewhere. And that somewhere is going to shape our outlook. It's going to shape our methods. It's going to shape our questions. It's going to shape our biases. It's going to shape our blind spots. And that's neither good or bad. But it's to be aware that we all come from somewhere, both individuals, as our personality, as our upbringing, as our background, then as our professional formation, in our education, and then in our socialization as scholars. And I would encourage you to reflect on how your positionality relates to the work you do, the interests you take, the approaches you take, the assignments you submit, the methods you use. These are all influenced by our positionality in this space. So thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to your questions.